Good morning and welcome back to Nachyami. Today we're going to be learning together Esther Perek Gimel, the third chapter of the book of Esther. And this is where the story itself actually begins. The story of Megillas Esther technically begins. The topic of this Perek, as we learn it, is Haman's plan. And Perek has 15 psukim in total. It's divided into two main sections. The first section is the first 7 psukim, roughly half the Perek. And this is a section in which Mordechai does not bow down. Let's take a look at the overview and then some points to ponder on each of the two sections. First section, the 7 psukim, we're told that there's this individual who is promoted through the ranks of the king, and his name is Haman ben Amdasa, the Agagite. And he is made he's put in a station above all the other ministers, and everybody is expected or responsible to bow down to this Haman. However, Mordechai does not bow, he does not prostrate himself in front of a person. And the king's courtiers tell Mordechai, why is you're not listening to what the king has to say? It's not a good idea. And they keep telling him, but he doesn't listen to them. And they therefore go and tell Haman that Mordechai's not bowing to him. And Haman and Mordechai is not bowing to him, and Haman gets really upset about this. He gets filled with anger, and he doesn't want to just get rid of Mordechai, because that he could do in an instant. And he knows I'm Mordechai. He knows the nation. This is a nation. He decides he wants to destroy all the Jews. So what he does is he takes a poor, which is a translated from Persian into Hebrew as goral. It's the lottery, and it falls out on the 13th of Adar. So now let's just understand just a few things to think about, a couple questions in this section, is why was it that Haman was promoted? You'll notice, as Rav Amos Chacham points out in his Pirush Dat Mikra on the Megillas Esther, that there's no tangible or logical reason given for his promotion. He arrives suddenly out of the blue and he disappears almost as fast as he arrives. And that's really the procedure, that's the way it works when HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants something really bad in the world to happen. These agents of evil suddenly just appear out of nowhere and they disappear as fast as they came. This is really a pattern we see throughout history. So it doesn't help to try to logically understand socioeconomically where he came from. He was a force of evil that was unleashed upon the world. However, Chazal do try to give a little bit of background. So Chazal say that in fact he was Memuchan. And why is it that suddenly he gets the promotion? So Rav Yosef Ibn Yechia explains that the reason is because up to now, Memuchan's first suggestion was to get rid of Vashti, had a little bit of a bad aftertaste. The next morning he woke up when he was suddenly sobered up and he realized, he's not so good without his wife. So it wasn't so good. But then when the courtiers and his chambermen suggested this whole business with all these young ladies, which generated a life full of lustful pleasure for him on a nightly basis, it actually turned out all right. You know, he gets Esther as part of the equation. Everything seems to be fine. So now he turns back to Memuchan and he says, you know, Memuchan, not a bad idea. So that's part of the promotion process which is going on over here. It's interesting that it could also be, as the Malbim points out, that it folded into this was that there was just a foiled assassination attempt, and who was the one who revealed that was Esther. And even though she revealed it in the name of Mordechai, it could be that the king just says, oh wow, Esther is the one who saved my life. Who got in Esther here? And he views it as Memuchan's doing. So this is mismatched appreciation, which goes to Haman, which really is due to Mordechai. Later on, that's obviously going to be corrected when Mordechai gets to ride on the horse, which Haman is going to pull, which is, so to speak, the justice of that. Why, and this is the biggest question we have to answer, is why did Mordechai not bear down? I mean, essentially, he is causing the genocide of the Jews. Yes, he is dealing with a maniac who overreacted, but in the end of the day, if Mordechai just bowed down, then this would never have happened. So why? Why is it so important that he has to stand his ground in this particular episode? So we're famously understand that there's a Midrash, Esther Rabbah, which tells us, Rashi quotes it, that Haman had a Avodah Zarah around his neck. He had a pagan deity around his neck, and Mordechai was not bowing down to him on religious grounds. Or it could be that he himself made himself into a deity. It is worthwhile noting that the text itself, if you read the Megillah, there is no indication of that. This doesn't seem to be the theme of the Megillah whatsoever. It doesn't seem that this is a struggle against paganism whatsoever. So Chazal might be saying something deeper than this. There are a few other suggestions. Rav Yaakov Meidan, as an example, says that the reason why he has to put his foot down now is because he's demonstrating that in the face of evil, in the face of bad, bad people, passivity is not an option. You cannot simply allow the evil to exist. Rabbi Chaim Angel points out that he is repulsed by Ahasuerus himself, meaning to say, really, Mordechai was the one who deserved the accolades of the foiled assassination, but that goes to Haman. Achashverosh is a big brute who is taking the role of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, is taking the role of Hashem in this Megillah. He takes this role in a number of places we'll see throughout the Megillah, where it's almost a theological battle of Achashverosh versus HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is what the Gemara in Megillah Daf Tes Vav Amud Aleph says, that Rav describes that at the beginning of the fourth parak, it says, Mordechai Yodayas Kol Asher Na'asah, Mordechai knew all that was happening. Rav Omar, it says, Gava Haman Me'achashverosh, that ultimately Haman, so to speak, was more powerful than Achashverosh, but Shmuel says it refers to that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so to speak, was trumped, Malki Elohim Malkata, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, in a certain sense, was being taken over. The power, the central power and authority figure in the Megillah is Achashverosh, and Mordechai needs to demonstrate that this authority figure does not have the authority that he actually pretends that he does have. There is another very fascinating piece that I had the opportunity of working on with Rabbi Foreman on Purim, and he points out that what the dynamic which is going on over here is that Haman is taking the seat of power of his master. He's taking the seat of power, Achashverosh. He's wearing the king's clothes. He's having people bow down to him. You don't bow down to anybody except the king. It seems clear from the Pesukim that Achashverosh did not realize quite exactly what Haman was demanding of people in terms of bowing down. Later on, we're going to see that he reaches to the crown by asking for the king's horse and to be clothed in the king's clothes, going in the public. Haman desires everything. He wants the seat of the king. Mordechai, by not bowing down, is maintaining the one thing which separates Haman from being the king himself, which is the bowing down to him. He does not want to give Haman the undue credit, the undue respect, which is not really fitting for him. This matches two other stories in Tanakh. I'm going to leave this for further homework, and that is the Eitz Hadas Tovara, where Adam is requested not to have one thing, not to take the Eitz Hadas. That's why the name Haman comes from Amina Eitz Hazeh, which comes from the Garden of Eden episode. And another place which is very fascinating, another fascinating parallel, which the Medrash already builds up on, is Vayi Kamron Olav Yom Yom, when the courtiers say to Mordechai every day, please bow down. It matches another part in Tanakh with H.S. Potiphar requesting of Yosef on a daily basis that he have a relationship with her. And he would not do that because they would be taking the seat of his master, Potiphar, which again, he was not willing to do. He's not going to live the life of his master, which means even living as with his wife. So these two dynamics set into motion an idea of Mordechai preserving the legacy and the position of Achashverosh. Worthwhile exploring that a little more. Another question over here is, what is his business with the Goral? Why is he using a Goral? So the Ralbag says it's because he wanted to see if it's a propitious time. That's why before even making the suggestion to Achashverosh, he says he wants to know if this works out. He wants to see how it's going to play out with the Zodiac. It is interesting to note that the Yesh Elohim points out that this is ideological. It's not just practical. He says, I want to show the nation of Israel, which believes in divine providence, Hashkacha Pratis, that I'm going to kill them, I'm going to slate their destruction and their genocide at a time which is completely random, and they'll have nothing to do to be able to stop me. Meaning to say, I'm going to show them that this destruction will be completely and utterly random and out of their control. And the irony is that the whole festival is called Purim Al Shem Apur because of that lottery, to show that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is operating even from within the unknown of probability and chance. The Malbim points out, just as an interesting aside, that in fact the month and the date that it fell was the furthest from the time that they were standing in right then. And that is because they were in Nisan now. So the first month from that was Adar, and the first day, actually, interestingly enough, was the 13th, which is the furthest from where they were right now in the actual days as well. So HaKadosh Baruch orchestrated that the longest amount of time, first doing the days and then by doing the months in that order. Okay, we move to the second section of this parak, which is the last psukim from Ches to Yotezov, and this is really when Haman makes his presentation to Achashverosh, and he says, look, there's this nation, it's scattered among the provinces of the king's kingdom and empire, and they don't really, they're a little different, their laws, their practices, they don't really respect you and your system. It's not worth leaving them alone. You know what, if it's good for you, let me just completely destroy them, and I'll give you this 10,000 talents of silver, I'll put it straight into the royal coffers and chambers. The king takes off his ring, he gives it to Haman, and he says, go ahead, whatever you want to do with it, no problem. And he says, Ach, kesov nosunach, you have the money back, do whatever you want. And so he writes these letters, he sends them off, right there and then to all the far reaches of the kingdom, demanding destruction for the Jews, la'arishmid, la'arog, la'abed, is kol ha'yodim, from child to elderly, from even the young infants to women, all on one day on the 13th of the 12th month, which is Adar, and the edict leaves, and all of Shushan is in a state of Novoicha, it's crying, it's an Avelus, and in the meantime, Achashverosh and Haman are sitting down to have another feast. A few points to ponder in this section is, what is this whole business with the silver? Where's the silver coming from? So Yosef Ibn Yechia points out that this is from the loot which will be achieved by sending the Jews out. By killing the Jews, you'll be taking all their possessions, and by giving their possessions to the king, this is in a certain sense a bribe to the king. It's worthwhile noting that this was a pattern in many, many of the other options and opportunities throughout Jewish expulsion throughout history. So, for example, when the Jews were expelled from England, they were expelled from England from the year 1294, almost 350 years. So it's interesting to note that that also surrounded financial hardships. What happened was the Jews were relegated to being money lenders because the Christians were not allowed to do that, and so they ultimately became money lenders, and they were actually did pretty well off that because they were able to charge interest to such a degree that the king was in so much debt, and the Christians, who were out on their war efforts, were in so much debt that they resented the Jews being so successful because they were moneylenders. And in 1275, Edward I decreed that Jews could no longer loan money for a living and would have to convert to being merchants, laborers, or owning farmland. What is interesting is by 1290, he was under so much pressure, and there were such large debts because of the wars and the crusades that were going on, and the war in the south, he needed to negotiate a financial settlement. So the way he did it was he bartered, kicking out the Jews and cancelling the debts on society, with an edict of expulsion, which granted him, Parliament gave him a tax of 116,000 pounds at the time, which is the largest single tax of the Middle Ages. So it was a way of becoming liquid again because of kicking out the Jews. So this similar kind of proposition is being offered to from Haman to Achashverosh. It's worthwhile noting that in this episode, actually Achashverosh denies it, which means to say he believes in this for ideological reasons, not just practical reasons. This is also, and you see in Haman's speech here, a prototype for all anti-Semitic rhetoric. He doesn't mention that this is a personal vendetta, even though it is. He doesn't mention that the nation has a name. He makes it seem as if it's about issues when it's really personal. He mentions this group not being the same as everyone else, the perennial outsider, and he mentions them not keeping the law based on an anecdotal incident, rather, which is Mordechai not bowing down, rather than actually giving the details to the king. These are all four steps which you see in any need build up for anti-Semitic rhetoric leading to policy. And finally, we see at the end of the perek, they're drinking again. Why are they drinking? Do they have to have a feast every single perek? So the Malbim points out that perhaps, there's a little bit of a debate as how complicit was Achashverosh. Was he ideologically on the same page as Haman, or was he just really, completely a fool? Would he really had no idea what was going on, and Haman was manipulating him in the way that he saw fit? So in this episode, we see that perhaps in this way, the Malbim argues, shows that he is not complicit. He doesn't really know what's going on. And the reason Haman takes him to another feast is so that he can send off these edicts of genocide without the king being aware of the full ramifications of what his ring-giving was actually succeeding in doing. And so therefore it actually now diverts the king and takes his attention away from what was actually going on. This concludes our perek, and now we're going to see the reaction of Mordechai and Esther. In the meantime, have a wonderful and meaningful day.